Science is concerned with fact. There can be only one accurate formula for the speed of light. Religion deals in insight. There are many suggestive formulations for the laws of God and man. One wonders, therefore, at the narrow parochialism which seems to be the geography in which so many believers live. I have attended many seminars in comparative religion. I've read widely in this field, and I must confess, in all honesty, that by far the greatest energy is spent not in comparative religion, but in competitive religion. My faith is superior to all other faiths for this and this and this and this reason. And I wonder at this. No art historian or esthetician would be allowed to ply his trade if he deliberately blinded himself to the canvases of all but American artists. No philosopher would win appointment at any major university if he knew nothing but the thought of Anglo-Saxon writers. And yet in religion we seem to have the privilege of limiting what research we do to the narrow confines of one tradition. And in so doing, we deliberately cut ourselves off from some of the most interesting, significant, and suggestive understanding which men have produced concerning life, death, God, and immortality, the questions which puzzle men but have no single answer. I choose to begin this series on the spiritual giants of other faiths with the figure of Confucius. I do so in part because he is the least understood of the towering giants of faith, in part because of my feeling that he is in many ways the most suggestive to Western man. Think of the revolutionary changes that would take place in our homes were we to adopt the Confucian doctrine of filial piety. Gone would be the battle for the telephone, that feeling of living in the vortex of a whirlpool, the backbiting, the sister and brother baiting, the lip which parents feel they must accept from their children, because according to Confucius, the only anxiety a parent should feel for his child comes when the child is ill. Otherwise, the responsibility for his actions rests entirely with the child. What manner of man was Confucius? You recall some 10 or 15 years ago, there was a short-lived fad of formula which began with the phrase Confucius say. These formula were pithy statements such as tend to appear in the Reader's Digest. They fell into the category of lowercase wisdom. Confucius say, he who has cash today have credit tomorrow. The kind of wisdom which is coined by those who wish to shortchange knowledge. Out of this fad, we came to look upon Confucius as a phrase maker, a man who erected proverbial wisdom, who went about spouting aphorisms. We saw him as a smooth-faced, smiling, somewhat teethy Chinese mandarin, enigmatic, and at the spur of the occasion would drop a bon mot. Nothing could be further from the truth except the attribution to Confucius of most of these formula which were said in his name. Confucius disparaged those who were clever with language. Language, he said, ought to express clearly and simply what is meant, and nothing more. He had no patience with those who, out of prudery, coin euphemisms, and those out of needs to sell an item or public relate themselves, devise cautious circumlocutions. To Confucius, an essential principle was that of the rectification of names. This is a uniquely Chinese problem and has to do with the pictographic, the symbolic quality of their language. They have no alphabet, only picture symbols. But in essence, he meant this, that every object, every person, every action must be labeled exactly as it is. Death is death, and not eternal sleep. Disease is disease, and not temporary indisposition. Armies are armies, and not defense establishment. Spying is spying, and not paramilitary deployment. Surliness is surliness, and not adolescent rebellion. Confucius looked at the world directly. And indeed, it is a classic fact that all the great religious geniuses of mankind have looked at the world as it is, with all its confusion, all its chaos, all its cacophony, all its changeability. They have seen the world straight on, not through rose-colored glasses. And it is this quality, this ability to be realistic about men and about society, which permits them to erect towering philosophies of life. Confucius was, above all else, a realist. When one of his disciples pontificated that that which he would not have done unto him, he would not do unto another, Confucius raised his hand and said, "Son, you have not yet reached that point." And when another disciple bragged about the quality of his previous teachers, about his knowledge and his virtue, Confucius again paused, raised his hand, and said, "My son, I have yet to see any man who prized virtue more than he prized women." A man who will look at life, at man, realistically, such a man can erect great statements of faith. What was Confucius's faith? Who was he? What did he hope to accomplish? Confucius is the name of a Chinese sage scholar of the 6th century before the Common Era, Kung Fu Tse. Our word Confucius is the Latinized form of Kung Fu Tse, as it was reported to Rome by the Catholic missionaries who went out in the early Middle Ages to, quote, convert the heathen, unquote. Master Kung Fu Tse, was born of the aristocracy of ancient China. He was born in a century of chaos and turmoil. The early empires which had governed China had crumbled and dissolved into 100 competing duchies and counties. And Confucius was born of the ancient aristocracy, but of an aristocracy now dispossessed, which had lost its prerogatives and its possessions, and maintained only its family traditions, its family trees, and the desire to better itself as best it could. We know very little about his early youth. He received such education as was available. Education in China was largely, a preparation for civil service and for government. Education was open only to the upper classes. Those who would inherit rule were prepared for rule. Those who were of the déclassé, the impoverished upper class, were prepared to administer the estates of the emperor, the dukes, the counts, and the like. Confucius was prepared in political science and public administration. And indeed, the bulk of his thought begins and centers on political theory. We are used to looking on political theory as a question of the construction of the ideal state. This was political theory as it was conceived of by the Greeks. Ought man to be ruled by a democracy, by a monarchy, by a theocracy, by an empire? What was the ideal state? What is the ideal constitution? What ought to be the law of this state? What ought to be the balance of power between executive, legislative, judiciary? These are the Western political questions. Confucius, as a political theorist, denied that these were the cardinal issues. To him, the question of political theory par excellence was not the type of government of a state, but the quality of the personnel who governed the state. He was indifferent to the form of political organization, for he felt that as long as those who manipulated power, enjoyed power, were good and disciplined and just, any form of state might successfully carry out its functions. Confucius believed that the crucial problem for the political scientist was to create a sufficient number of men trained in public administration, but more than that, convinced that office is a sacred trust and not a license to steal. He believed in a psychological theory which we might call the theory of infectious goodness. He says in his Analects, which is a collection of statements reported by his disciples to have come from his school, from his academy, he says in his Analects that the ruler who is above reproach will find his government effective even in areas for which there is no legislation. And the ruler who is reprehensible will find his government ineffective even in areas where he has legislated with a heavy hand. In short, he believed that by personal example, the emperor could stimulate the great heads of bureaus to set an example for those in the next rung and those below them. That goodness was contagious, that a passion for justice was contagious. That if the father in the home, and it was from the home that Confucius drew his insight, if the father in the home is just and acts as he preaches to his children, if he is sensitive and deliberate, there need be in such a home few rules, for the children will instinctively attempt to live up to what they know to be the expectation of their parents. But if, on the other hand, the father is sham and pretense, full of words, a windbag, as we say, he may fill his home and he may impose upon his children 1,000 restrictions, but he cannot compel them to abide these restrictions, for they will have no respect for the authority which promulgated them in the beginning. And so, arguing from the home, Confucius said, so it is with the state. If people have confidence in those who administer the state, if there are no deep freezes and no mink coats and no conflict of interest, if they know that those who are in office are attempting to do their best, are exerting their utmost in behalf of the mass, the polity, then they will obey the law. Indeed, they will obey that which they simply feel to be required of them. It is only when a population feels that it is being imposed upon, misruled, abused, that its monies are being siphoned off not for public purpose but for private gain. It is only in such a case that there is unrest and discontent and social turmoil and a dislocation of the normal functions of the community. Confucius then was faced with a very practical problem, and Confucius was above all else a practical man. Was it enough simply to preach to the rulers, you, Duke Chu, are unworthy of office, you, Count Lu, are worthy of office, you, administrator so-and-so, you may continue? Should he be a Nathan, come before King David to criticize, to castigate, to point out error and ill? There's very little of prophetic passion in Confucius. Rather, he was an architect of change rather than a prophet of change. And so he set out not to denounce the emperors and the dukes and the counts, but to build up from within a group of public administrators whose quality would shame those who inherited rule by their example, and who, by occupying positions of power, would bring stability to the confused Chinese world. He developed a school of public administration, perhaps the first graduate school of public administration in the history of the world. But unlike any known before or since, this school was not designed to be a practical school. There were no case histories of problems, of taxation, of marketplace control, of police and safety and welfare legislation. This, he felt, could be learned on the job by practical experience. Rather, in his academy, he prepared men for public administration by requiring them to prepare themselves personally, morally, and spiritually for the office which they would occupy. In Confucius's school, and it was a loose school, it was an academy, a group of men who came to him infrequently. There were no registration, no hours, no examinations. Simply, Confucius was one of these charismatic people who attract to them men of quality and men of ability. These men came, and together they discussed morality, ethics, the purpose of government, the way an administrator should demean himself and comport himself and conduct himself, the qualities which make for personal ennoblement, the way a man can rise above his temptations and his lust and his greed. And in such discussion, Confucius felt that he was forging administrators who would be able to carry out and discharge any practical problem presented to them. He attracted to himself sons of the nobility. And by the morals and the suasive character of the school, they affected in time all of China. China never developed, as we did in the West, the doctrine of the divine right of kings to rule foolishly. The feeling that simply by inheritance, through the genes, through the blood, a son inherits from his father, who inherits from his father, from some divine progenitor, the right to impose his will upon the mass. In China, they've never developed a way to prevent a son from inheriting from his father. But the inheritance of the son was not made legitimate, except the son discharge his office dutifully, justly, and well. And in later China, under Confucian influence, there developed the office of the censor, which was a bureau in Peking whose sole function it was to review the activities in office of those who were charged with responsibility, to recommend those who should be maintained, to discharge those who had failed to abide the high standards required of them. And even the emperor's role was presumably reviewed. Confucius sanctioned, indeed, in his political theory, revolution against the emperor, if the emperor was not exercising his office as it ought to have been exercised. What were the principles of morality which Confucius taught in this school? In the first place, the principle of Zhen. Zhen is a Chinese word made of two picture symbols, the symbol for man and the symbol for the number two. He taught that the essence of morality involves the relationship between man and man, between father and son, husband and wife, man and his business competitor, man and his government superior, superior with inferior. The purpose of life was not to prepare yourself for some nebulous afterlife. The purpose of disciplining yourself, of preparing yourself in life, was to live as a sensitive, just, dignified, respected, and respectable human being in the world in which you found yourself. Zhen meant to establish securely, soundly, and well all the relationships which occupy you in your daily life. The relationships of the home, the relationships of the marketplace, and the relationships of government. Man's first responsibility was to order rightly the ways in which he lived with his fellow man. And how was he to know what was expected of him? Here Confucius developed a doctrine which is known as Li. Li could be translated roughly the principle of balance. Without Li, learning is pedantry. With Li, learning is understanding. Without Li, boldness is rashness. With Li, with this sense of balance, boldness is steadfast courage. Without Li, caution is timidity. With Li, with this sense of balance, caution is correct natural prudence. Without Li, filial piety is servility. With Li, filial piety is devotion. Without Li, love is lust. With Li, love is the enrichment of every human relationship. Li is a principle of moderation, of circumspection. Nothing in excess, everything in thoughtful balance. And if you apply this concept of thoughtful balance, if you bridle your tongue, if you rein in your natural instincts, then in essence you have the Confucian attitude towards most moral situations. Balance, a measured quality to life. Confucius was a moralist. He believed in justice and rectitude and character as much as we do. But he believed that the way to achieve this was not by a passionate onslaught against against the injustice and the indignity of life, but rather a stoic fortitude in the face of the indignities of life. Accept life as it is. Retain your composure, your self-respect, your sense of balance. And then the cruel winds of life may blow, and you need not feel blown down, uprooted by them. And more than any moralist who has ever lived, Confucius emphasized that morality begins with mannerliness, with good manners, with a rule of conduct and the conventions of conduct. He delighted in ritual. He felt that in every aspect of life, in every relationship, there was a correct way to address those with whom you lived, a correct way to dress, a correct way to bear yourself, a correct demeanor for your face. He felt that man ought to be circumscribed in his actions by a set of conventions which governed almost every aspect of his personal life. He did not shrug off good manners when he closed the door of his home. Indeed, his home was a citadel of mannerliness. His politics were mannerly. His dealings in the marketplace were governed by a fixed set of rules and of conventions. He knew what was expected of him. The man with whom he dealt knew how to address him. They knew how to conclude their deal, to resolve what was between them, because in China there developed a set of conventions which overlaid every human activity. Now, conventions may degenerate into formality, but we who live in an unmannerly age can well appreciate, when we think in our own lives of the occasions when manners might have stopped up our tongue and prevented us from uttering some rash, regretted statement, we can understand how indeed a convention of manners can oil the intricate relationships of life. If we are in business and there is a way to address and to be addressed, if we are in politics and there is a way to present one's case and to listen to the opposition, we somehow find life can be carried out a little more sweetly, We can still state what we mean, but we state it somewhat more gently. We state it somewhat in the minor key. We avoid being emotionally involved in the statement we are making. We remember that we cannot throw ourselves over, lose our sense of balance. We are in control of ourselves, control of our thoughts, and control of our actions. Confucius taught China the quality of good manners. And just as when the Supreme Court justices in the United States conclude their deliberations in their chambers, and come before the public to render their judgment, upon entering the court, each turns to the other eight judges and shakes his hand, as if he had not spent hours in bickering and discussion and argument with them. So this public activity of ceremonies, of rites, of conduct, permitted the Chinese to live together with amity and with a certain degree of concord. The home was not split asunder by a single argument. No doors were slammed. And if they were, the family knew that at the next meal all were expected to be there. Conversation was expected to continue. The father was expected to lead in the evening prayer. The mother was expected to make the dinner table conversation, and the children were expected to maintain discreet silence. Meal after meal, meeting after meeting, discussion after discussion, all governed by an inexorable law of manners, saw to it that life went on. Life was maintained. The family was maintained. The integrity of the community was maintained. Whatever the arguments which tended to rip the fabric of society apart. These then are the teachings by which Confucius hoped to produce a generation of public administrators who would govern wisely for the benefit of the people, who would govern justly and bring peace and order back to his beloved China. And indeed, Confucian ideas became the norm, the accepted pattern of Chinese life. In China until very modern times, one advanced in the civil service by means of a group of civil service examinations. But unlike our own, they did not involve competence in a particular field, but competence in the Chinese religious classics, competence in the field of ethics, on the presumption that having mastered what Confucius had taught, having discussed morality and ethics and philosophy, having passed one's examination in these courses, one was somehow a partner with Confucius in what he believed to be right. One had become a better person because of this study. How shall we sum up the teachings of Confucius? What relevance do they have to our own lives? There is in Chinese thought generally a basic principle of life which is called yin and yang. These are the two opposite life-giving urges, and they are represented as two dewdrops nestled and circularly together. Yin is the female, the earth, the darkness. Yang is the male, the heavens, the lightness. And in their interrelationship, in the tension between the two, life goes on, life progresses, life is sweet. The yang of human life comes in Western civilization. The urgency, the passion, the Amos, the Isaiah crying out against injustice. The yin comes in the Orient, in the East. The passive, the stable, that which looks on life for its sweetness, for its orderliness, which seeks to give form and structure to life as it is. In our day, the East would do well to borrow the passion of the West. She is far behind the West in eradicating age-old injustice. And in our day, the West would do well to look upon the East, to preserve the civility, the good manners, the code of conduct which makes life within the home and life within the community possible and sweet, which gives it stability and continuity, which expresses our respect of others and allows others to respect us. Amen.